This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
The murder of Tupac Shakur has generated nearly 30 years of rumours, conspiracy theories, and unanswered questions. Now the mythology is about to meet the courtroom as the trial gets underway and Nevada prosecutors try and solve the mystery of who killed Tupac and what really happened on the Las Vegas Strip that night in 1996. It's time to separate fact from fiction. I'm Anushka Mutanda-Dowty, and for the BBC's Fame Under Fire podcast, I'll be inside the courtroom every day and I'm bringing you with me. Join me for Fame Under Fire, the Tupac murder trial, the testimony, the arguments, the moments that matter, and all the legal analysis. Listen on BBC.com or wherever you get your podcasts.
BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Welcome to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. It's the virtual space where experts on one of the big issues of the day tell you and me what's really going on inside 28 minutes. In this edition, petrol bombs and water cannon on the streets of Belfast. 23 years after the Good Friday Agreement, is the peace beginning to unravel? On Wednesday of last week, one of the gates in one of the peace walls in Belfast was breached by rioters. It was the culmination of a week of escalating violence in parts of Northern Ireland. Then, everything went quiet to mark the period of mourning for the Duke of Edinburgh, which will soon come to an end. This week, I want to know, 23 years on from the signing of the Good Friday Agreement, whether the peace process is in peril and what might be done to save it. Step into the briefing room and together we'll find out. First, a primer on the recent violence. Here's Catherine Morrison, a reporter for the BBC in Northern Ireland. She starts with a big funeral last year that many of us didn't notice.
The funeral of the veteran Republican Bobby Storey took place back in the summer of 2020. Now, he was considered the head of intelligence of the IRA for a period, and his funeral took place when COVID restrictions were fairly tight around who could attend. So there was controversy when a large number of people turned out, including senior members of Sinn Féin. Complaints were made, and it emerged in the last few weeks that the Public Prosecution Service had decided not to prosecute anyone involved. That decision did meet with anger from unionist parts of the community. For example, Arlene Foster, the First Minister and the leader of the DUP, who called for the resignation of the Chief Constable of the Police Service of Northern Ireland. Riots then took place over the following days. There had been a few nights of pretty localised, low-level disturbances in a loyalist area of Londonderry, but then trouble spread to Belfast. We saw the police being attacked with bricks, bottles, fireworks, kids as young as 8 or 9, burning bins were pushed up against Land Rovers, and then later, once darkness had fallen, the petrol bombs came out. The people I've spoken to in loyalist areas like the Shankill Road, they have spoken about the Northern Ireland Protocol and the anger that surrounds that. That's the element of the Brexit deal, which basically ushered in a trade border in the Irish Sea. It's a feeling that their identity as members of the United Kingdom is somehow under threat by that. On April the 7th, a bus travelling up the Shankill Road was stopped. Its driver and passengers were ordered off. Windows were broken and it was petrol bombed. They let the handbrake off, so sort of a flaming bus was heading down the Shankill Road. Most people in Northern Ireland thought scenes like these were consigned to the past. Even the police officers themselves said, you know, this is the most intense disorder that they have seen in recent years. After consecutive nights of trouble in loyalist areas, The violence spread to an interface area of Belfast, and those peace gates which separate the Unionist Shankill Road and the Nationalist area of the Springfield Road. Here we saw crowds gather on both sides attempting to attack each other. You know, since peace and since the Good Friday Agreement, you know, momentum has been building to try and open these peace gates to allow the two communities to move between them. But the serious disorder at that interface was of real concern to the police and to politicians, who had feared that this would become sectarian and it would become incredibly dangerous.
You're watching BBC News. We have just received a statement from Buckingham Palace confirming that the Duke of Edinburgh has died.
After the announcement of the death of Prince Philip, we saw messages appear on social media and posters actually appear in Loyalist areas calling for protests to be postponed as a mark of respect to the Queen and the royal family. But they did call for continued opposition to the Northern Ireland Protocol and what they've described as other injustices against their community. The underlying reasons and issues behind these protests haven't been resolved in any way. And we've got the summer and the marching season coming up. I don't think anyone would be surprised if violence did break out again on the streets.
Catherine Morrison. As we heard, most of the trouble was in Protestant loyalist areas. One young man arrested on Easter Day gave this explanation for what was going on.
I don't think young people really understand the details in terms of the Irish sea border and stuff. I think what they're being told and what they're seeing reflected in the media is that Sinn Féin are winning, the Republicans are winning, and that our identity is under attack. And when they hear those words, when they hear that stuff, and then they're told, all right, and the way that you can help is by going out there and throwing bombs, sticks and stones at people, they're more than willing to do so.
Is that typical? The Shankill Road in Belfast is one of the best-known loyalist localities. Joining me now in the briefing room is Eileen Weir. She grew up in the area during the Troubles and now works at the Shankill Women's Centre. Eileen, was the violence that you saw last week worse and different than the usual?
Oh, yes, absolutely. Absolutely. We would have interface violence all year round, arranged by social media, but never petrol bombs. So, yes, it was way beyond what our norm would be here, yes.
How much did you feel it had to do with big external factors like Brexit and the Northern Ireland Protocol?
I think it was a consequence of that, but I don't believe that the youth that was out there causing the disturbance are youth that actually listen to the news or read newspapers. The youth who were causing it, I think, were set up to fight a political issue by community propaganda. Community propaganda is one of the strongest motivators for people to take some type of action. And unfortunately, it's the working class communities that's suffering.
So in other words, it's not something which you could say that they were taking a deep interest in the particularities of, let's say, the protocol, but they were aware of and animated by a general sense of something being lost or something being in jeopardy.
Absolutely. Absolutely. There is a fear, and you can just need to look back last year due to COVID, and only COVID, we didn't have our traditional 12th of July parades or our bonfires for safety reasons. But, you know, I mean, that was a big part of people's culture. And then when the RIC border and the Brexit and the talk of border polls, you know, we just have to listen to our politicians here, not speaking from a one voice. Yes, there is issues. I live on my own, and I'm noticing even when I go shopping, my shopping has increased dramatically on the price of food that I have to pay for now. Now, we're living, and I work in the most deprived areas in Northern Ireland. People just cannot afford to pay extra for their food. That's one issue of the protocol that affects the grassroots. I'm not talking about businesses. I'm not talking about people with money and industry. I'm talking about the basic needs for people who are already in the poverty trap, having to pay more for their messages. So if mine increases by £10, what does a family of four increase? You have to understand a lot of these young people who are out, they've no prospect in life, no jobs, no nothing. 75% of those young people that were at that interface in Lanarkshire weren't from the Shankill. You know what I mean? They were from all over. They travelled to the places where they can get a bit of excitement. You know, COVID lockdown didn't help. Our youth clubs are not opened. You know, our training centres are not opened. So that was a bit of excitement.
And what about the, if you like, some of the subcultures around, like some of the criminal organisations? Are they involved in any kind of a way?
I would say yes. We have criminal gangs that benefit from our young people. They're involved in drugs. They're involved in cigarettes coming in, cheap cigarettes. So when the international flights stop, their cigarette runs stop. Maybe they're not getting their drugs in as easy because of the protocols that's there. These criminal gangs don't get furlough.
So if you don't feel particularly well represented, the community doesn't feel particularly well represented by local Northern Irish politicians, from what you're saying, how does it feel represented by politicians at Westminster and the government?
Well, personally, I don't think we get very much support at all from Westminster. I believe that Boris has to put his hands up here. We were told there would be a flow of goods between Great Britain and Northern Ireland, and that is not the case. That is not what's happening. So he has to put his hands up and hold some responsibility in what he agreed to for Northern Ireland.
Eileen Weir, let's look now more widely at the grievances apparently being felt by the unionist communities. Joining me now is Sam McBride, a journalist at the Belfast newspaper, The Newsletter. Sam McBride, are loyalist paramilitary groups, as far as you know, involved in the recent violence?
Well, what the police have told us is that paramilitaries individually were involved in some of these riots. But maybe if I just tell you what I saw a week ago at a riot just off the Shankill Road, really the cockpit of much of the loyalist paramilitary activity in Belfast, and a very, very staunchly loyalist part of Belfast. There was no obvious protest. There weren't banners. There weren't placards. I didn't hear any political slogans being shouted. But you had people wearing balaclavas. That's not something you see in supermarkets in Belfast from people who are a bit cautious about the virus. There was no attempt to hide what was going on. Children were being shown by one of the individuals in a balaclava how to make petrol bombs, directed as to where they should go, how they should launch them at the police and towards a different part of Belfast in which there are nationalists. This really had all of the hallmarks of loyalist paramilitarism. But if it is not loyalist paramilitary violence directed from those organizations, then what we're seeing is perhaps equally concerning, because what that means is that in their areas, in the heartlands that they control, they're impotent to stop this happening. There is a younger cadre of loyalists who feel that their leaders, much like unionist leaders on the political front, have been too weak here, too accepting of what has happened, haven't done enough. They don't want to be seen to wade in and stop this. But either of those things, I think, are potentially very dangerous and very significant for the future.
Now, of course, apart from the moment of the breaching of the peace wall, most of the violence has been directed against the police. And it's in this moment, or just before this moment, that the First Minister herself has called for the resignation of the Chief Constable of the police service. That feels very dangerous. Now, why does she do this?
This is a very curious and I think fascinating aspect of this story. Arlene Foster made this call, I think something like an hour, certainly within a couple of hours, of the Public Prosecution Service in Northern Ireland announcing that they would not be charging Michelle O'Neill, the Deputy First Minister, or any of the other Sinn Féin members who last June had attended a massive funeral for Bobby Storey. There was a point here where Sinn Féin were under incredible pressure. There was great anger. And Arlene Foster, I think, acted very quickly to try to take the pressure off her partner in government, off her political rival, but somebody who she needs if Stormont is to survive. And therefore, she turned her fire, if you like, on the chief constable, said that what had been revealed about the police involvement in this was shocking and it meant that he had to go. And that immediately meant that there were at least two fronts here for people who were critical of what had happened, both the police and Sinn Féin, not solely directed at Sinn Féin. The difficulty, of course, is that in the longer term, that creates its own separate problem, that there is a situation now where the chief constable has said he is not resigning, but there is now this incredible strain between all of unionism, really, because all of the leaders have now joined her in saying that he must go, and the police service, which is going to have to police the future in Northern Ireland.
Can I just ask you about Sinn Féin's actions here? Because it was their funeral, it was their attendance at the funeral, which prompted a lot of this. Wasn't that incredibly reckless?
I think it was. I think most people across Northern Ireland are pretty united on that. Even within republicanism, even members of Sinn Féin in a highly unusual way have spoken out in some cases to say this was wrong. It was disrespectful. It is something of the Dominic Cummings moment for Northern Ireland. It is a situation where people who are powerful and who make the rules are seen to break the rules. This has done enormous damage to Sinn Féin.
Do you think they regret it?
I think they do regret it. But as with many politicians in all jurisdictions, one of the things that always amazes me is how reluctant politicians are to publicly make clear what everybody else knows. Of course, this was a mistake, if it was a mistake. If it wasn't a mistake, then it was quite wrong. But rather than say that, they are insisting they did nothing wrong. They're sorry, they say, in very carefully coded words, that the public health guidance was undermined. Rather than straightforwardly, it shouldn't have happened. And they won't do it again if similar circumstances arise.
Now, according to your reading of this, Arlene Foster called for the resignation of the chief constable partially to take the pressure off her relationship with Sinn Féin, which is the relationship essentially that has to make the Northern Ireland Assembly and executive and Stormont work. The whole thing has collapsed at least once before. What do you think the dangers are of it happening again?
They are acute right now. I think that Stormont is really hanging by the thread of the pandemic right now. You can't walk out of government at this point where people are dying, where people need government decisions on a daily basis and expect to get any credit from your supporters. But once that recedes, if that does, as we hope recede over coming months, Stormont is in a really precarious position. Many of the protesters on the streets on the loyalist side are openly saying that they want that to happen. There are shrewder heads in unionism who basically see that Westminster imposed the sea border over the head of Stormont, and so therefore it might not be the best idea to give Westminster complete control over what is happening in Northern Ireland from a unionist perspective. But there really is a sense here that Northern Ireland is, certainly from the unionist side, being treated disrespectfully, if you like. They are having things imposed upon them from outside, and that causes some unionists to question the utility of Stormont. What is the point of having it if it isn't able to prevent really significant constitutional damage to the union? That is a very dangerous situation in Northern Ireland. That is a feeling which I think straddles both the streets in terms of what the loyalists are thinking and doing in some of their areas, and very affluent, middle-class, respectable parts of Northern Ireland, where people would abhor the violence that they have seen in those areas, but feel very deeply that they are being cut off by a Westminster system that really doesn't care about Northern Ireland's place in the Union.
Sam McBride, there are several key actors in the Northern Ireland drama, and three of the biggest are external: the British government at Westminster, the Irish government in Dublin, and the European Union in Brussels. How might their actions mitigate or worsen the situation? I'm joined now in the briefing room by Katie Hayward from Queen's University in Belfast and Etain Tanham of Trinity College Dublin. Katie Hayward, before we come to look at what the governments have been doing, just a quick question about politics in Northern Ireland. Are nationalism and unionism still the only games in town?
So the Good Friday Belfast Agreement set up certain institutions for power sharing between unionism and nationalism. But there's always been a middle ground, i.e. the non-aligned, those who say they're neither unionist nor nationalist. And that non-aligned ground has grown. And we've also seen the Alliance Party in particular do well over the last few years. And we'll be looking with interest in the Assembly elections next year to see how well they do and whether that middle ground retains its basis.
Now, what is the perception among the various Northern Irish communities about how committed Westminster and politicians at Westminster are to Northern Ireland?
I think there's been some knocks, possibly, to the confidence of people in Northern Ireland across the spectrum as to the commitment from Westminster, maybe even Britain more generally, towards Northern Ireland. Obviously, the Brexit process itself, given Northern Ireland voted in a majority to remain, that, of course, has consequences in terms of people's confidence there. But even if you look at public opinion surveys in Britain, YouGov polls in particular, what we've seen is an increasing number of people saying in GB that they wouldn't be bothered if Northern Ireland left the United Kingdom. So certainly sort of against this background, there's a doubt about sort of commitment to Northern Ireland in some regard. More politically, I think it's probably worth remembering that there was quite a knock to confidence around Westminster's commitment to Northern Ireland and the UK government last year when Secretary of State for Northern Ireland, Julian Smith, who was very popular across the spectrum, that's not easy to be, across the spectrum in Northern Ireland, after having negotiated the New Decade, New Approach deal that re-established power sharing here, he was replaced by Brandon Lewis. And I think that sort of was a bit of a message that at the highest levels, the UK government was prioritising perhaps Conservative Party politics and preferences over the interests of Northern Ireland. And this is sort of exacerbated by the debate around the protocol on Ireland, Northern Ireland.
I want to come to the protocol in a moment. But, Etain, what is the perception in Dublin about the commitment of politicians in Westminster to the process?
I think, in a way, it's similar to the things Katie has said. There's been a huge dent in trust, more than a dent, between the Irish government and the British government. So there is a sense that the relationship has to be, as the Taoiseach Micheál Martin said, reset, because over the past nearly 5 years now, there have been concerns about limited communication or no communication over something which is so vital for not just Northern Ireland, but for Ireland as well. So I think there has been a big increase in distrust and a difficulty in trying to engage the British government.
Now, let's talk about this question of the Northern Ireland Protocol and the consequence of Brexit, Katie Hayward. Clearly, from what we've heard, it causes both resentment and difficulty amongst communities in Northern Ireland. Is there any practical way of making the effects of the protocol less onerous? And then let's deal with the question about whether or not they are steps that are likely to be taken.
Yes, so there have definitely been difficulties associated with the protocol. And I think some of the reasons for the deep anxieties amongst some sectors of the community here relate to the fact that we know that we're just at the beginning and that when we have full implementation of the protocol, some of the requirements associated with it will be even more onerous. And it is notable that the two main bodies there, the Specialised Committee and then, of course, the UK-EU Joint Committee, which are charged with overseeing the running of the protocol, they have quite a lot of scope to manage the protocol in a way that makes it responsive to the needs of Northern Ireland.
Well, that's quite interesting. So let's just talk a little bit about what kind of thing can you do to make the protocols less onerous, which don't drive a coach and horses through the protocol itself?
I mean, first and foremost, we have the challenge that the UK's intention is to go in a distance between its rules and those of the EU. So that's immediately a challenge. And I think the EU's approach to the protocol sort of reflects that recognition that the UK intends to diverge and therefore it wants to see the protocol rigorously implemented to stop any weakening of the integrity of the single market as a consequence of that.
Etain, from the Dublin perspective, is Dublin saying effectively to the EU, let's do absolutely everything we can to make this less problematic?
Yes, very much so. When the Commission said it was going to trigger Article 16 of the protocol with respect to vaccines moving freely across the border, the Taoiseach Micheál Martin intervened very quickly about that and the decision was reversed because it was so politically sensitive. But secondly, the Taoiseach has also said and asked the EU to have calm heads and also asked the UK to have calm heads in these discussions and negotiations. But to my knowledge, it's the first time that an Irish Taoiseach in these negotiations intervened in that manner, not reprimanding the European Union, but really making a case for flexibility.
Katie, is it your impression that if there can be more flexibility on the protocol, that will actually make a material difference to what is now kind of rather charged politics, particularly in the unionist communities in Northern Ireland?
Yes, so there's a responsibility jointly upon the UK and the EU to agree these changes and adjustments. And I think that's worth remembering because we've seen increased tension in that UK-EU relationship as a result of the UK taking unilateral approaches to trying to mitigate some of the effects of the protocol. Longer term, that's not sustainable. So if we have agreement between the UK and the EU on technicalities and adjustments of the protocol, this would bring two benefits. The first is, of course, the immediate benefit for business, reducing unnecessary burden and making the protocol less onerous for them to have to deal with. But also politically, it would be a very good sign of the UK-EU working together rather than being at loggerheads.
So does that mean you're hopeful that despite the troubles that we've been seeing this month, that things can be sorted out?
I believe it is possible for them to be sorted out, but there are many ways in which you could see things getting more difficult. So in and of itself, we're in a much more unstable situation, and there are reasons for both unionists and nationalists to feel uncertain and worried about the future. And I think we're in a particularly difficult environment now where language is being used that inflames people's sense of anxiety and anger. And whereas in the past, there's no legitimation of any violence, that it's completely roundly condemned and it's seen as an absolute affront to Northern Ireland society, I think there's a risk of sort of a tendency towards legitimating it.
It's saying Katie paints a picture where actually, if I read it rightly, it's finally poised and actually we could be in trouble or we could move away from trouble. How do you see it going?
I agree with a lot of what Katie's just said. With the current British government, there is such low trust and there's such unpredictability as well. So I think that's where it's finally poised. It's hard to predict and trust isn't there. But I would emphasise very strongly the need for a strong British-Irish intergovernmental relationship, because that works in various ways. It works to provide, under the logic of the Belfast Good Friday Agreement, greater security and, I suppose, guardianship of Northern Ireland. It provides a security umbrella, a stability umbrella. They are, as Micheál Martin said, that the governments are the custodians of the agreement as well. So I think at that level, that would provide a more optimistic picture if that relationship could strengthen. But I think a factor that has to be included as well is politics in Ireland, in the Republic of Ireland, because Sinn Féin has a significant support base now. And obviously that would create heightened insecurity for unionists in Northern Ireland. So it's another factor in the mix. And on that basis, I think there are so many variables which can increase insecurity. So I think the next months and year or so definitely are fragile.
Etain Tannan there and Katie Hayward. My conclusion at the end of all that is that the peace process is complicated, it's fragile, and it needs tending. Who knew? My thanks to Catherine Morrison, Eileen Weir, Sam McBride, Katie Hayward and Etain Tannan. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The producers were Tim Mansell, Paul Moss and Kirstine Knight. The sound was mixed by Rod Farker and the editor is Jasper Corbett. And if you enjoyed this podcast, you might like other editions of The Briefing Room, which are all available on BBC Sounds. There's the one in which we investigated the mysteries of short selling and the role of hedge funds. There's our one-hour special on how countries the world over have dealt with the COVID pandemic. And there's the one about the huge container ship that blocked the Suez Canal for 6 days and what that taught us about global supply chains.
Hi, this is Jane Garvey. I really hope you enjoyed that podcast. I'm here just to tell you about a new one on BBC Sounds called Life Changing, in which I get the chance to have some really I hope, insightful conversations with people who've lived through some extraordinary challenges and experiences. Just have a listen.
I knew, I said, this is it. I didn't know where I was going, what I was going to do. And literally, like what is seen in the films, I just took apart my mobile phone and threw out the SIM card. And I just drove as fast and as far away as I could.
We just quietly stood there. Just the stunned disbelief. You cannot believe what you're looking at.
I just want to get inside your head here. You're sitting there in your house in Wales, yeah. And you're messaging a woman who's Malaysian royalty, as it turns out, also your half-sister.
Yeah.
I mean, have you got a cup of tea there with you, a packet of hobnobs? I mean, this is crazy, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely crazy. It's absolutely crazy.
Join us if you can. I promise you won't regret it. Subscribe now to Life Changing on BBC Sounds.
The murder of Tupac Shakur has generated nearly 30 years of rumours, conspiracy theories and unanswered questions. Now the mythology is about to meet the courtroom as the trial gets underway and Nevada prosecutors try and solve the mystery of who killed Tupac and what really happened on the Las Vegas Strip that night in 1996. It's time to separate fact from fiction. I'm Anushka Mutanda-Dawati, and for the BBC's Fame Under Fire podcast, I'll be inside the courtroom every day and I'm bringing you with me. Join me for Fame Under Fire, the Tupac murder trial, the testimony, the arguments, the moments that matter, and all the legal analysis. Listen on bbc.com or wherever you get your podcasts.